Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for November 13th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, climate change predictions, the function of telomeres, creating hermaphroditic worms, and overcoming the challenges to become a scientist. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how babies learn through crying, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Next month, scientists, policymakers, and heads of state will meet in Copenhagen for the United Nations Climate Change Conference. In the run-up to the summit, Science's Dick Kerr reports in this week's issue on what's changed since the 2007 assessment by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, as well as the delicate task, researchers say, they have of communicating to the public the seriousness of the climate situation without overselling it as a done deal that no one can do anything about. Here's Dick Kerr.
Since the fourth assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change came out in early 2007, there's been a lot of climate science news coming out, and it's been mostly bad news. We've heard about ice disappearing from the Arctic Ocean. We've heard about meltwater gushing into the ice of the Greenland ice sheet and slipping it into the sea. We've heard how we're not doing very well on carbon emissions. In fact, they're globally shooting up over the last few years. And that more informal news is lately being formalized, backed up by reports coming out. We just had one in September from the UN Environment Program, which tended to sum up all these, in fact, added in any number of bits of news that the report took to be much worse than what IPCC was anticipating back in 2007.
In what way, how well or poorly have the IPCC's predictions matched what's been happening with global climate change?
Well, the United Nations Environment Program report, UNEP report, points out that a lot of things are happening faster and sooner than the IPCC report had it in 2007. Things like the carbon emissions, Arctic sea ice loss, acidification of the oceans, warming of Arctic land, rise of sea level. And the UNEP report gives that as a clear warning that it's time for action.
What does it mean if global climate change is happening faster than predicted by the fourth assessment of the IPCC?
Well, if things are happening sooner and faster than IPCC had it, then the message that UNEP and a number of scientists are trying to send is that December's meeting for negotiation of a climate treaty should take the bull by the horns and get something done right away.
How's that message being received?
Well, some recent polling would suggest that this message of heightened concern isn't getting through to the public anyway. There have been a couple poll results, one just last month, another earlier in the year. The American public, at least, is less concerned about global warming. It is less convinced that it even is warming. And the American public, a larger portion of the American public, believes that the whole global warming thing has been exaggerated.
Now, back in 2007, the IPCC report got a lot of attention. Al Gore and the IPCC panel won the Nobel Peace Prize. Al Gore's movie, The Inconvenient Truth, had come out only a few months before in 2006. They all sort of appealed to kind of an emotional argument. Has that basically worn people out, in America anyway, in a time where there are wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, failing economy, all these other things for people to be concerned about emotionally?
It's hard to say whether the public has been worn out by these repeated calls about a crisis in the climate system Or more conservatively, perhaps, they've just been distracted by those things that you're talking about. Healthcare reform, Iraq, Afghanistan, the economy. So whatever the answer, it would seem that the message of heightened concern is not getting through. And there are some ideas about how you might work around that. People who study communications would suggest making your appeal more personal, say to personal health, make your appeals more local, more regional, rather than global. And given the way the communication media are going, it might be a good idea to find different routes between the scientists and the public.
Also, at the time of the IPCC fourth assessment, there was a lot of talk about the words very likely, as in global climate change was very likely to have a human cause. Has that level of consensus changed since 2007?
No, I think climate scientists still feel strongly that global warming is undeniably here, that it's going to get worse, and that something should be done sooner rather than later. The differences seem to come between two groups of climate scientists, those who are pushing the heightened concern line and those who are concerned, very concerned, but don't see this much heightened concern since IPCC. Yes, the Arctic sea ice is going away a bit faster than IPCC had it or the models they had at the time. The ice sheets are moving a bit faster than anticipated, but that doesn't make them much more concerned than they were before. They thought IPCC 2007 had it right, and that was very strong evidence. It was compelling evidence that something should be done. So they're worried, but not much more worried than they were before. They thought that was plenty of evidence to prompt the kind of action that people are looking for at Copenhagen.
The U.S. President Obama has already made clear that he's not planning on attending any of the talks in Copenhagen next month. Is that being seen as a message in terms of how much weight the United States government is placing on climate change issue, or?
I think the strongest message is coming from Congress and the way Congress is not going to be able to get around the climate change legislation by December, who knows when. I mean, that's the message that's going out, that the U.S. can't get its act together. And that's what folks in Copenhagen are going to be paying attention to.
Why is that happening?
Well, you can see that in the way climate legislation is being pitched to Congress. It's a jobs bill. It's a recovery bill. It's an energy policy bill. There's really infrequent mention of climate change and that personalizing thrust that the experts would like to see. And I think that reflects the failure for the appeal of the science and the impact of climate change to get across to the American public. They're probably the toughest sell. And of course, the politicians are also distracted by all these other things going on in the States. And they don't seem to be able to get around the fact that somehow reducing greenhouse gas emissions to the extent that scientists are calling for, it's going to be tough. It's going to cost money. And that's a hard sell on the Hill these days.
Dick Kerr, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Science's Dick Kerr writes on the growing urgency to address climate change. Also in this week's Science, the function of telomeres. In a Viewpoint article, Titia DeLange writes about how these protein DNA complexes protect the ends of linear chromosomes, a topic that garnered the 2009 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. Science's senior editor Guy Ridehoff spoke with DeLange about it, and here's an excerpt from that interview in which DeLange describes how scientists are trying to understand how the cell doesn't consider telomeres as damaged DNA.
Work in the 1980s taught us that eukaryotic cells have a very vigilant system with which they monitor the genome for the presence of DNA damage. So there are two different systems in cells that constantly surveys the DNA in chromosomes to detect lesions. And if lesions are detected by either of these two surveillance systems, cells arrest in the cell cycle. And in addition, cells have the ability to then repair these lesions. They use two main repair pathways to repair broken chromosomes. Now, if you think about it, activation of these pathways at the natural ends of chromosomes would be a disaster. If the natural ends of chromosomes would be perceived by the cells as DNA damage, the cells would arrest in the cell cycle. And in addition, if the repair pathways would engage on the natural end of the chromosome, inappropriate products would occur. So, for instance, one repair pathway just simply glues DNA ends together. And if it would do that at chromosome ends, natural chromosome ends, it would make fusions of different chromosomes, which are unstable in mitosis. So these kinds of studies illuminated that there is a second problem with having linear chromosomes that I refer to as the end protection problem. So we have the end replication problem. It's basically solved by our knowledge of telomerase. And then there is the end protection problem, which is still a challenge to understand how cells manage to create natural chromosome ends that are not perceived as DNA damage.
So you mentioned that telomeres are long repeats of simple sequences put there by the telomerase enzyme, and that solves the end replication problem, and it solves the end protection problem as well in ways that we don't fully understand.
Yes. So we know that telomerase adds these simple repeats, and these repeats somehow confer resistance to these DNA repair pathways. And the question is, how can this be? It's just a DNA sequence. Why would cells know not to alert their DNA damage response pathways when these repeats are present at the ends of DNA? And so a lot of work has taken place over the past 20 years to try to understand how this works.
Titia DeLange there, talking with Science's Guy Ridehoff about the function of telomeres. You can find the whole interview with DeLange in the online version of the Viewpoint article titled How Telomeres Solve the End Protection Problem. A U.S. federal judge recently ruled that a landmark lawsuit may proceed in challenging the legality of patenting genes. Here with more about it is Science's Policy Forum editor, Brad Weibel.
District Judge Robert Sweet has denied requests to dismiss a case challenging patents covering two human genes associated with breast and ovarian cancer. The genes are called BRCA1 and BRCA2. The American Civil Liberties Union filed the lawsuit in May on behalf of several patients, clinicians, and medical organizations. The group contends that patients who are tested for mutations in the genes cannot receive second opinions because only one company, Myriad Genetics, holds the right to perform the test. It also says that the patent restricts outside physicians and scientists from conducting research on the genes. The plaintiffs are seeking not only to overturn the BRCA patents, but to end gene patenting altogether by asserting that gene patents are unconstitutional. Some observers had speculated, erroneously as it turns out, that this broad approach would result in a case dismissal. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office is a defendant in the case, along with the two parties that control the patents, the University of Utah Research Foundation and Myriad Genetics. They have not commented publicly on the recent developments. Critics of the lawsuit feel that the elimination of gene patents would significantly discourage innovation in the field. In his ruling, the judge wrote, "The widespread use of gene sequence information as the foundation for biomedical research means that resolution of these issues will have far-reaching implications, not only for gene-based healthcare and the health of millions of women facing the specter of breast cancer, but also for the future course of biomedical research." The case will proceed in early December.
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. There are two different mating systems in the genus of worms, Coenorhabditis. Coenorhabditis elegans, or C. elegans, has individuals that are either male or hermaphrodite. C. raimani, on the other hand, has male and female sexes. But in both the hermaphroditic C. elegans and the females of the C. raimani species, the animals have two X chromosomes characteristic of females. In a paper in this week's Science, Ron Ellis and colleagues report that they have created hermaphroditic self-fertile C. rahmani worms from the females of the species by lowering the expression of just two genes. The team suggests that the evolution of hermaphroditism, in the genus Cnidaria at least, probably required just these two steps, neither of which alone is detrimental to the survival of the species. I spoke with Ellis from his office at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey.
We're looking at one of the great systems for doing genetics, roundworms, and looking how different species of roundworms created this complex trait of self-fertility, which is pretty dramatic when you think about it. Most species have females. They have to find males and mate to reproduce. But several of these nematode species in the recent past have developed the ability to make their own sperm and self-fertilize and reproduce without males. And what's been very exciting, and it's the heart of this article in Science, is that we could show that by simply making two changes to pre-existing genetic pathways, one could take a female animal and cause it to become a self-fertile hermaphrodite. And it shows us a picture of how a complex trait might have originated.
What leads to the development of males in the system where individuals are hermaphrodites or males?
From a pathways perspective, a group of genes acting in a process we call sex determination specifies which animals become male and which become hermaphrodite or female, depending on what species we're looking at. And these genes are controlled by whether the animal has one or two X chromosomes, and then they act in every cell to tell that cell to either develop as a male cell, helping to produce a male body, or as a female cell, helping to produce a female body. And if you totally turned off the genes of the sex determination pathway, you would have animals that only developed as one sex, because its job is to make both males and females in some species, or to make males and hermaphrodites in others. That would be bad. However, small changes in this pathway can alter its effect in one of the two sexes, but not in the other sex. And that's what we've been studying.
So this is sort of a neutral, take it or leave it kind of mutation, evolutionarily, these small changes.
We suspect that they would have been quite favorable for animals that needed to colonize new environments frequently, because if those animals acquired the ability to self-fertilize, then each individual worm could go out, find a new area, and reproduce, even if another animal of the opposite sex had not made it to the same new home. So it could have been quite favorable. Or if the animals are in a large population and don't need to colonize new environments, it might have been quite neutral, as you suggested.
Now, you said, though, that hermaphroditism developed from the male and female system.
Correct.
What else is needed, then, besides the slight alterations to the expression of this sexual pathway?
The second thing that is needed is to alter how animals control when sperm become active and look for eggs to fertilize. In nematodes, in the males, lots of sperm are produced, and they're stored in an inactive state until the male finds a female and mates with her. And the process of mating activates these sperm. They then go and they look for eggs to fertilize so that the male can have children. The hermaphrodites normally don't have any process for activating sperm. They don't need to. They arose from female ancestors, which didn't make any sperm. So as soon as an animal was confronted with mutations which would allow the former female creature to make sperm and look like a hermaphrodite, it was in something of a quandary. It had sperm, but the sperm wouldn't work without mutations altering this other pathway that keeps the sperm from turning on prematurely. And so it's the second pathway, the sperm activation pathway, which is also critical. It had to be altered so that the newly developed hermaphrodites could turn on sperm early in their lives so that they could have self-progeny. But it could not be altered so that it no longer worked in the males, because male sperm still needed to be kept inactive until they found a mate.
So changing this pathway, does that harm the worms or keep them from reproducing if you just did that, changing the sperm activation pathway?
What we found is that if you only alter the sperm activation pathway, the animals seem pretty healthy. the treatment we did does not have a very large effect on males. They still made sperm which were in large part functional and could fertilize hermaphrodites. If the pathway were completely wiped out, the sperm in the males would activate very early and wear themselves out and might not still be useful when they mated with hermaphrodites. The nice thing about all of these studies, what in fact makes studying evolution with these roundworms so wonderful, is that we can use this technique of RNA interference to lower the function of different genetic pathways very easily without totally shutting off these pathways. As you could imagine, most pathways exist for good reason, and if you shut them off altogether, it would be bad for the animal. But being able to lower their activity slightly without destroying them lets us explore the kinds of changes which might also have occurred during evolution.
Can the two interbreed, the mutants that you and your team created with the wild-type worms?
Yes, and we've done most of our experiments by allowing them to interbreed. So if we make a new hermaphroditic animal from what was once a female, it can have self-progeny, but if it mates with the male, it can have cross-progeny, like is normal for that species. In fact, because mating with the male is the ancestral pattern which has been favored by millions of years of evolution, that cross is actually very efficient. They still have lots and lots of children. So what we find with the new animals we've created, and what is true of species which have hermaphrodites, like the model animal C. elegans, which a lot of labs study, is that the hermaphrodites self-fertilize, which is new, but can also mate with males. They retain this older function that the females had. Two different ways of reproducing, and they do whichever one works best in their current situation.
Are these pathways conserved among other animals in the animal kingdom, us, for instance?
That's a great question. And one of the surprises about studying how animals develop sexually is that most aspects of these pathways are very different in nematodes or in insects or in humans. So many of the things we learn can't apply from one species to another. But that's not true of everything. And a colleague, Dave Zarkar, about 10 years ago, showed that certain genes in the pathway which control how nematodes become male or hermaphrodite or female are also functioning in insects, and indeed, they're functioning in vertebrates, in fact, in humans. And his lab now studies mice as a model for how humans work, as well as working on these roundworms. So parts of the pathways are different, other parts are similar. Now, normally, each kind of animal has a very complex group of genes working together to cause each individual to become either a perfect male or a perfect female. But, of course, these systems start with the same genetic input. We all have the same chromosomes, and somehow that common genetic information has to be controlled or channeled to produce the two different sexes. That means there's a possibility of making intermediate forms, which sometimes happens by mistake in humans, and which is controlled in these nematodes to evolve self-fertile hermaphrodites, which have both female characteristics, they are XX animals, but also the male characteristics of being able to make and activate sperm. And everything we see confirms Darwin's original idea that older traits, here the older pathways, were co-opted to create something new, but we can now look at how this process happened step by step, molecule by molecule. And these details give us a lot of insight into how other complex traits might also have originated.
Ron Ellis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ron Ellis of the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey is senior author of a paper on the mutations in two independent pathways that are sufficient to create hermaphroditic nematode worms.
As with every editorial I write, it's almost always on something I've been thinking about for a long time.
Science's editor-in-chief Bruce Alberts has an editorial in this week's issue on overcoming the challenges to become a scientist.
And, of course, I've had extensive experience with graduate students, and I've seen graduate students in good situations and bad situations, and especially at UCSF, where I've spent a lot of time worrying about making graduate students successful. I've sort of come up with these certain ideas, which I have been conveying to students whenever they come and talk to me, but I thought it might be worthwhile writing it down.
Now, this advice, you say, is coming in part from what you've observed to be successful, but also you write from your own early experiences, including your mistakes. What happened?
Well, I made a lot of mistakes. My own personal experience was I started out being enormously successful as an undergraduate. You know, I just stepped into a research problem and I thought science was going to be easy. And then as a graduate student, I became enormously overconfident and was very unsophisticated in how to design research strategies. And as I've written about in an article cited in the editorial, I had lots of problems during my PhD thesis, working on ambitious problems, but not with... I don't fault myself for choosing interesting and important problems. I fault myself for not actually knowing how to design a research strategy that would be effective. But I think I learned from those failures, and they were very important in shaping what I did next in my postdoctoral work and the whole approach I took.
Take us back to that time when you were getting your doctorate, 1965. What was going on in your life? Where were you? What were you about to do? And what did you start thinking?
Okay, so I actually had been influenced by Watson and Crick's great discovery, as had so many other graduate students, to think that theoretical biology was going to be the way we would move forward. Watson and Crick predicted something, how genetic information was carried, and it was dramatically successful. And so I and many others were trying to predict the next step, and particularly in my case, the next step in how the mechanism of the replication of DNA that Watson Crick predicted, how that mechanism would be carried out, given the fact that in an intervening time and just shortly before I began working, Arthur Kornberg had discovered the enzyme DNA polymerase, which earned him a Nobel Prize. So given the properties of DNA polymerase and my bent for theory, I actually wrote a term paper for a graduate course, got me an A, on how DNA might be replicated by just one enzyme, DNA polymerase. And I would think it was fair to say that most scientists at that time expected DNA to just be replicated by DNA polymerase, which was, of course, a wonderful discovery. And so my theory and my experiments were predicated on a false assumption that that enzyme could, in fact, copy double-stranded DNA, the form of DNA in the cell. And that proposition was, of course, not correct. And the fact is that many of my experiments at that time were tests of my theory, and they all came out negatively because my theory was wrong. But that wasn't really teaching anybody anything except that somebody had a theory that was wrong. It's not a good way to do science. And so the dramatic result was 5 years after I started my PhD thesis at Harvard, and when I went to my oral exam, even though I don't think we had ever heard of anybody failing their oral exam for their PhD thesis near the end or at the end, I did fail and had to stay for another 6 months. So that was a very formative experience. And I think without it, I'd be a very much less effective scientist in retrospect, actually. But at any rate, of course, those things are always painful.
How does that experience with getting your doctorate translate into what you make sure to do in your own lab today?
Well, you know, I've observed with time in advising graduate students that it's not effective to give them really close supervision on exactly how to do their experiments, because that's what you would do with your technician, but you shouldn't be doing that with a graduate student, because a graduate student that's successful under those circumstances and gets their degree is going to be in trouble later on when they have to do their own research. I think based on my own experience and on what I've seen from others, everybody has to make their own mistakes. And as I say in my editorial, time and time again, I've seen talented graduate students basically struggle until they suddenly catch on once they've done one piece of work that they thought of with their own idea and made it work. And because you can't really be an effective scientist and take the kind of risks you need to take to be successful unless you have confidence. And you get the confidence from having a success. So I guess in retrospect, I would say a graduate student that I supervised too closely, I never gave him him or her the chance to gain that kind of confidence.
You've described in the past two types of strategies for doing science: pursuing obvious experiments or ones that professors might have laid out for you, and racing perhaps with other labs to get to the end result of those experiments, or something a little riskier, investing time in a method and then using that method again and again to publish new results. At what point do you switch? How do you make that decision to switch from one way of doing science to the other?
Well, I think people have different personalities and enjoy. There are a few scientists I know who enjoy this sort of competition, this race. I never enjoyed it. I didn't think it made it for a very good atmosphere in my laboratory if people felt they were racing against somebody else doing the same thing. So although you can't guarantee this, you try to design research strategies for your lab and for your students that even if they take a long time to publish their results, still will be valuable because it's not completely at least redundant with what other people are doing. So you try to be innovative and different from what other people are doing since you want to make a unique contribution with all that work you're putting in. Well, I don't want to give the misunderstanding. The lesson I took from my own failure was that I should try to design the method because I had a good idea for a method. But I do not want to say that designing a method and going ahead is the only way or even necessarily the best way of designing a research strategy.
One last thing. From your editorial, you mentioned that scientists need to select their mentors wisely. And then you say, what constitutes a good choice is not always obvious. Where might people screw up?
So, in graduate school, you're there to learn science, not to become a famous scientist. So I think it's a bad mistake to jump into a laboratory that happens to be at the moment on the cutting edge of some exciting field, because by the time you're ready to become an independent scientist, maybe 8 or 10 years later, after the time you begin your graduate school career these days, that field's not going to be exciting anymore, or at least if it's exciting, it'll be certainly overcrowded. So I think it's a bad mistake to choose your PhD advisor on the basis of what you find exciting at the moment. Sometimes it could lead to working in a very large laboratory where you're sort of, just one of many pairs of hands on a project that doesn't give you the kind of independence and imagination and time. Because if, this big lab is racing with a bunch of other big labs, you may not have the time to develop your own ideas. You feel under such pressure. So I really do believe that the important thing for a person starting in graduate school is to find a good environment working on a problem that, in a roughly an area that they find of interest. You have to find it of interest, but not to be primarily motivated by the most exciting thing that they can imagine doing at that moment. That might be fine, but it might not be fine. You need to look at the environment in which you're going to be working, the kind of mentoring you're going to get, the kind of ethical standards that scientists have, that is, giving credit to others, helping young people, being more broadly interested than simply their own fame and recognition. So that's why I wrote the editorial, to try to help young people think about this. And of course, the way you find out about a potential mentor is to talk to other people who've worked in that group or people who work in the same field and know that person well.
Bruce Alberts, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science's editor-in-chief, Bruce Alberts, on his editorial this week on Becoming a Scientist. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how babies learn through crying. Dave, what's the story about?
Well, Rob, this story is about how babies learn their native tongue. And researchers already knew that babies sort of get used to their mother language, as it were, even as far back as in the womb. The last 3 months of pregnancy, fetuses' ears are very well developed, and researchers have shown that they are attuned to sounds in their outside environment, including their mother's voice. And then by about 4 months of age, infants begin babbling in their parents' language or languages. So researchers in this study wanted to figure out, is there something that happens in between that time? In other words, even very early on, are babies showing that they have some sense of what their native language is?
And so the researchers looked at crying?
They did. They recorded a lot of baby cries, and they looked specifically at German and French babies in this study, and that may be because the research team was actually based in Germany.
How old were these babies?
The babies were about 2 to 5 days old, and they were just crying spontaneously. No babies were harmed in the making of this study.
Okay. So you brought some sound files with you. I'm guessing these are baby cries.
They are. And listen to this first cry.
Okay.
Now listen to this cry.
Okay, they both sound like crying to me.
Right, they do. But if you listen carefully, you'll notice that first cry had sort of a rising, what researchers call a rising contour.
Let's hear it again. Okay.
And here's the second one, which has what researchers call a falling contour.
I hear it now. Okay.
Now, what's interesting about the differences between these cries is that French babies tended to make cries with these rising contours, where German babies tended to produce cries with the falling contours. And those contours actually match up very well with the typical melodies that are inherent in these babies' parents' native language.
Okay, let's compare. French?
Mon bébé pleure.
French baby. German.
Mein kleines Kind weint.
German baby. Huh. Are the researchers done here? Are they saying, okay, we've got this? I mean, how often did this happen?
Well, Rob, in this study, researchers only looked at a couple of languages, French and German, and they say, you know, to really figure out if this effect really holds true, if babies really are evincing these sounds in their native languages, they've got to look at a lot more languages. And their next step is actually to look at Chinese and Japanese. And the researchers say they even want to look at hearing-impaired babies to see if their cries differ from other babies' cries.
Okay, so what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from recognizing language in the baby's cry to pigs that can recognize themselves in a mirror, this next study is all about a complex mental ability which you and I take for granted, which is the ability to see our reflection in the mirror and know that it's us.
How do you tell if an animal can recognize itself in the mirror?
In this study, they took pigs and they put them in a pen with a mirror, and they kept the pigs in there for about 5 hours. And what the pigs did at first is what a lot of animals do when they see a mirror. They sniffed at it. They grunted at their own image. One pig even slammed into the mirror so hard that it broke the glass. These are all indications that the animal thinks it's seeing another animal in the mirror. In this case, another pig. They're not seeing themselves. And this is a common mistake a lot of animals make. So at first, the researchers were like, well, looks like pigs can't recognize themselves in the mirror. But over the course of the 5 hours, the researchers noticed something interesting. It looked like the pigs were starting to recognize themselves in the mirror. They were starting to understand what the mirror was. And to test that out, the researchers gave the pigs another test. This time, they put a bowl of food in the pen, but the food was only visible if the pig looked at the mirror because it was hidden behind this barrier. So the pig could only see the food if it stared directly at the mirror. And if it could actually understand what the mirror's purpose was, then it would know the food wasn't actually in the mirror. It was, say, behind them. And that's exactly what the pigs did. And I think about less than 25 seconds, most of the pigs in the experiment were able to correctly identify where the food bowl was and go straight towards it and start eating.
So they looked behind them for the food.
They did. One pig wasn't so bright, it actually looked behind the mirror for the food, which is actually what you would expect if a species doesn't really understand the purpose of the mirror. But in this study, the vast majority of the pigs knew where the food bowl was.
What's it mean? What's it really say anyway, if a pig can recognize itself in a mirror? What's that matter?
Well, first of all, puts the pig in a very elite group of animals that include humans, some other primates, some parrots, and even elephants and dolphins. But it's not a very big group. And researchers see this as evidence for actually sophisticated intelligence because it shows self-awareness. It shows that pigs can sort of understand that they are, for all intents and purposes, by being able to recognize themselves in a mirror. And it just goes to show what a lot of people have said in the past, that pigs are actually very intelligent creatures.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from complex thought processes in pigs to how complex thoughts might be contagious in people.
How so?
Well, Rob, this last story is about bad decisions. And researchers wanted to know, if you see somebody else making a bad decision, might that influence you to make the same bad decision? And this goes back to a field of research that shows that emotional states can actually be contagious. So, example, if you watch somebody cry, chances are you'll start to feel sad, even though maybe you have nothing to be sad about.
A measure of empathy.
Exactly. And so for this study, researchers wanted to see, does the same hold true for bad decisions? If you see somebody making a bad decision, might you start making the same bad decision? What they did was the researchers recruited a lot of undergraduate students, and they had the students look at a computer and watch what they thought was a text interaction between two individuals bidding on an object. And what they were told was it was each of these individuals had, you know, about 300 points that they had to bid with. And what would happen on the computer is the students would see one person bid 40 points and the next person up that bid by another 40 points, and this original person up his bid by another 40 points, and it kept on going like that.
They're trying to win something.
They were trying to win a prize, which the students were told was worth about $5 in real money. And what the students were also told was that if this first bettor went over his allotted amount of points, he was actually going to start to lose real money. They told the volunteers, you know, we paid this guy $12 in real money for this study, and if he goes over his 360 points or whatever it was, he's going to start to lose some of that $12 we're going to pay them. So objectively, what the students were seeing was they were seeing, you know, one of these bidders basically keep on upping his bid and getting really dangerously close to this point where he was actually going to start to lose real money.
But it's just text on a screen. Why would the students who are observing this care?
Well, the researchers threw in another layer. And what they did was they had some of the students identify with one of the bidders. They basically said, you know, this bidder, you know, was born in the same month that you were born in, or this bidder is in the same year of school that you're in. Some little detail that would make the students sort of potentially empathize with the bidder. And then what the researchers did was they waited till the bidder got really close to that point where he was going to start to lose real money. And then they had the student take over for the bidder. They said, okay, now you take the rest of this bidder's points and you start bidding on this object. And what they found is that the students that empathized more with these bidders tended to adopt the same bidding patterns. They were always trying to match the other person's bid, and they eventually were significantly more likely to place these high bids and to lose money than the volunteers that didn't seem to have anything in common with the original bidder and say, hey, I'm starting to lose money here. I'm going to stop bidding right now.
So they replicated the bad decisions if they empathized.
Exactly.
Are the researchers willing to extrapolate out from beyond this experiment what it might mean for society?
Well, they cite a really interesting recent example, which is when the Ford Motor Company was having all these financial difficulties and had to go through this massive restructuring. What they did was, instead of hiring somebody from within to take over this big effort, they actually hired somebody from Boeing, an aerospace company, to come in. And the researchers say Ford did a lot better with its restructuring than rival company General Motors did, who ended up hiring somebody from within. And what they're saying is that really the lesson to learn here is that feel like you're somebody that's making bad decisions, whether you're one of these big companies or whether you're somebody investing in a house that maybe is not going to pay off down the line. It's a really good idea to bring in somebody who's not only objective, but really somebody who really has nothing in common with you at all. Because even if you think you're bringing in somebody objective, if they start to empathize with you on a certain level, or if they feel like they have something in common with you, then they're going to start throwing good money after bad, just like you've been doing.
Hey, Dave, you want to come over and take a look at my house?
Rob, I think I know you a little too well to be objective.
Well, thanks, Dave.
You got it, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into a story about how you may be able to improve your foreign language skills by staring at movie subtitles, and also about how neurons make new memories. And for the science policy blog, Science Insider, we've got a story that deals with a new movie called The Men Who Stare at Goats, which is ostensibly based on a secret government program. And we've got some details about that program on Insider. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the November 13th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.